next week when we'll be in Hamilton, we will not have full audiovisual facilities. In fact, we're still working on the business of making sure that there will be audio perhaps able to be heard, and certainly making sure that everybody gets the transcripts reasonably promptly. As to my, that means we're probably likely to have to look at a bit of a reshuffle with your witnesses and put them in. And what that means for other parties who might have thought that they'd be coming a little bit later next week or even in the third week, it may well be that we could possibly be bringing some witnesses forward. I'd just like everybody to take stock in relation to their cases and their witnesses, and perhaps set out an email that would be sufficient to Ms. Kim, the registrar, if you've got any particular constraints in terms of the witnesses you intend to call and the timing of that, and whether they would be or not be available in Hamilton or in Auckland. Now, can I ask a general question? Does anyone consider that there'll be any need for any form of data projection at the hearing in Hamilton? Large screen presentation. We have most everything, I think, in our folders and also available on laptops and so on, but does anybody think that they might need a data projector? Excellent. And the third and final thing that I think I have at the moment, there's been a bit of to-ing and fro-ing in relation to the point source discharge case. I see Ms. Chappell is there. She kicked that off to OG, helpfully. And we've had a discussion about the way in which cases are to be presented. And the general expectation that the court has, which I think is what most of the people who are focused on the point source discharges accept and agree with, is that their cases, those parties, that's like the OG, the local authorities, etc., will present their evidence on the point source discharges during that week. Now, a follow-on from that is that anyone who is calling a witness dealing with issues affecting both point source discharges and diffuse discharges, it would be desirable if those who are dealing with the point source discharges can be available for the separate hearing. And we've had confirmation of that from Fonterra and Dairy New Zealand, thank you, and from Fish and Game, thank you, and from the Director General, thank you. Now, both the River Authority and the River Iwi have indicated they prefer to present their cases in their entirety at the time scheduled for doing so, rather than split them up. And I'll check, firstly, Mr. Ferguson, with you for the River Iwi. It appears to us, on an overview, that the extent of your case relating to point source discharges is relatively small. Is that fair?
That's even particularly relatively small is probably overstatement.
All right.
I think that's right, sir. Could I perhaps speed up? We've had a brief discussion with my friend Ms. Chappell. Her indication is that there may be a couple of questions that she would like to ask Mr. Brough. She would be happy if the court was happy with it if we are sitting in Auckland for that purpose, for Mr. Brough, who's based in Hawke's Bay, to appear by AVL. I have a challenge as counsel due to another hearing, but I will have a discussion around somebody stepping into my stead if required. There are no questions for Dr. Zeal, as I apprehend it from my friend Ms. Chappell. The River Authority's witness, I think, will need to be addressed on a friend.
Well, that may be something that Council can make sure of, whatever the arrangements are, and we can work with that. There would be other options potentially for a separate process with everyone by AVL at the time that suited, if it's only a small number of questions, Ms. Chappell?
Yes, sir, and I haven't had the opportunity, sir, to have that discussion with Mr. Ryan with respect to his witness,
Is that a similar situation?
I would imagine so, Sue. And it may just be that there are questions arising going across from
Mr. Ryan, are you there? Or Ms. Bulow for the River Authority?
And Ms. Bulow, I'm here, sir.
Yes. So, again, the court's high-level understanding from having looked at the evidence that you'll be calling is that, as with the River Iwi, the focus of your case on point source discharges is relatively small. Is that fair?
Yes, that's fair, sir. It is relatively small, and very minor Section 274 interest in those provisions.
Right. And have you heard what has been discussed, or the report of what has been being discussed between Mr. Ferguson and Ms. Chappell about how that might be handled for the River Iwi witnesses?
Yes, sir. So my understanding from that discussion was that there might be an opportunity to have a separate, sitting for questions for those witnesses.
Well, and it might be an ADL sitting.
Yes.
Right.
Similarly, we could arrange that if there are some
questions
for witnesses, but we haven't had an indication directly of that.
I know. Well, that's fine. I think we're still working through it. But I just wanted an indication at this stage. It appears on that basis that the point source discharge hearing in late October will be focused on the point source discharge issues. It will include parties who also have general issues who will make their relevant witnesses available for that purpose. To the extent that there appear to be two parties with witnesses covering both matters who don't want to split their cases, we'll work on having some special arrangement or arrangements, probably by AVL, to ensure that parties who are focused on the point source discharge matters can cross-examine those witnesses. So, Ms. Chappell, does that sound suitable?
Yes, thanks, sir. Were you anticipating that this would occur in the 2 days that we have allocated? Or
I haven't got that far.
I did notice, sir, that you made mention of the fact that the 26th of October might be available on Monday, I believe. But I'm not sure that the parties had...
No, I think I was doing that just to try and cover what might be there, and given the fact that I think from the court's roster point of view, it would be feasible. But I wasn't certainly setting anything down.
So that might indeed be a possibility in terms of that AVL timing, if that suited the party.
Well, as I say, that would be something, again, for you and other counsel to confer on and see whether or not that would fit. Yeah, I think, I mean, from our point of view, in terms of the court's roster, the whole of the week of following Labor Day is blocked out. So if that were suitable, then we could fit it in then.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I've heard from Ms. Cook that you may be travelling down to Parkson North on Friday, and your travelling may be arranged, or could be being arranged for you to depart on Thursday, which is the 26th.
Yes. Well, my life is not my own. but if it's only a small number of questions, then the morning of the 26th might still be available.
Thank you, sir. If I could just indicate as well that I assume that we're talking about those parties who are peripheral, so we're not talking about Dock and Fishing Gap, for example.
Well, no, that's as I understand it, is that, as I say, both the Department and Fish and Game have indicated that their witnesses whose evidence relate to point source matters will be available at that time.
Okay.
I'm really just trying to ensure that we cover everything. As I say, the authority, River Authority and the River Iwi both indicated they would prefer not to call their witnesses twice, and I'm not quite managing that, but I'm trying to accommodate it in some sensible way.
Yes, as I said, thank you.
Indeed.
So just a final point on that.
Yes, Ms. Ormond.
I have question for Mr. Trebolko that only relates to point source. It has no overlap with the fuse. And assuming Mr. Trebolko is going to be recalled for those days, I would intend to ask it then because I know Mr. Malone is interested in it.
That would be the desirable thing if it's focused on the point source discharges, is that we have a focused hearing on 24 and 25 October for that purpose.
Yes, thank you.
That is the plan, isn't it, Ms. Chapman?
Yes, I understand.
We're regarding you as the point person for...
I guess it is my client's name at the beginning of the appeal.
There we are. All right. Is there anything else then about any of those matters that anyone wants to check on or ask a question about or that I haven't covered? No? All right. So we return now to questions of Mr. Trebolko. You had completed, haven't you, Ms. Tumai?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Trebolko, do you have any questions for Mr. Trebolko?
No questions. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Mr. Medina.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Trebolko.
Good afternoon.
Now, I'd like to start with some questions in relation to a reference that His Honour made yesterday to the illusion of precision. Now, we're in a world where we don't have perfect information, aren't we? And it's a situation where, as far as information and also the tools we have, we need to use the best available information and the best available tools that we have.
Yes.
And I guess in a perfect world, it would be nice if we did have a model that was able to take into account all contaminants, apply to all land uses, and predict a perfect answer, but we don't have that, do we? And looking ahead, it may well be in the future that there could be new tools that we don't have available now.
Yes.
But from a Section 32 analysis perspective, it is really about looking at the here and now.
Yes.
Your evidence is clear that you do not consider that Overseer should be used as the rural gateway tool within PC1.
No, I don't.
There was mention earlier this week of the possibility of twin drafting gates. Would you agree that it's inefficient to have two drafting gates for farming activities?
Inefficient would be a kind way of saying that.
Well, how would you describe it then?
Well, I think it's very difficult if you have a farm that could be in a different rule depending on which tool they use. From a planning policy point of view, plan writing point of view, that just doesn't seem acceptable to me. And I would like to point out that the hearing decision version did allow an alternative tool to be used, but Schedule B explicitly said that that tool needs to provide values equivalent to Overseer. I can't remember if that's the exact word, but that was the intention for that very reason. They've got two tools, they've got to give the same answer.
And the reason why that alternative framework has been removed is because the only practical tool from your perspective is the risk scorecard in relation to dairy, and another tool doesn't produce the same sort of metric. Is that fair?
That's my understanding, yes.
Now, in terms of the risk scorecard, it's your evidence that that is a more effective drafting tool in terms of consideration of risk than, say, for dry stock, for example, which uses just a stocking rate.
Yes, that's right.
And so in terms of the purpose of the drafting gate, would you agree that it's not really about comparing one farm to the next? It's about, being a reasonably coarse filter to work out general risks of different farming activities.
That's right. We don't have any way of aligning tools for different farming activities, so it is just a general risk, the best we can do.
And in terms of the risk to the river, if you put it that way, of a move from overseer to the scorecard, the dairy, under use of either tool, we're still going to have the same number of farms requiring consent and being categorised under each class of or rule under the plan, aren't we?
That's my understanding, yes.
And so there may be some differences at the margins as far as which farm fits within which category, but
yes,
from an overall catchment perspective, they are essentially seeking to achieve the same outcome and will deliver the same outcome from a macro level as far as the number of farms falling into each category.
I consider that's true.
Thank you. In Council's opening submissions, Council took the Court through the various aspects of Plan Change 1 and the key points of difference between parties on different provisions. And there was, through that, particularly as far as the objective and policy, or the policy framework, there was reference to a number of the differences between the provisions put forward by Mr. Willis and your provisions, weren't there?
Yes.
Now, have you seen the updated provisions attached to the legal submissions for Fonterra and Dairy New Zealand provided earlier this week?
I have. I haven't done a detailed analysis of it, but yes, I've read them.
But would you accept that the number of differences between Mr. Willis and yourself now seem significantly reduced?
Yes, I do.
And in a lot of respects, the changes that Mr. Willis had been proposing to the policy framework was about the structure of those policies rather than about changing the substantive outcome.
Mostly true, yes.
Now, in terms of Plan Change 1, would you agree that as far as the desired outcomes that it seeks to achieve, that it essentially relies on a broad package of different initiatives, steps and mitigants that everyone essentially needs to do in order to help get us to where we need to go?
Yes.
And so within those suite of provisions, there's the minimum farming standards, there's the rule framework, and the FEP requirements. Those are all central components to that system,
yes,
aren't they? And as you've moved, I guess, through your period of involvement in Plan Change 1, following the decisions version coming out, it seems, reading your evidence, that a key thrust of yours, or a key intention, has been to maintain the overall direction from the decisions version.
Yes, that's
correct.
Yes.
So what I'm going to do now is go through some of the particular aspects where there is still a difference between the provisions being put forward now between Fonterra and Dairy New Zealand and the Council provisions.
Yes.
So firstly, in terms of FEPs and certification, would you agree that Plan Change 1's success relies on effective FEPs?
Yes.
And that certification increases the likelihood that FEPs address the matters they need to and are effective?
I think that's true.
And under the Council's provisions, there are opportunities for some farmer-prepared FEPs and then within Schedule D1, and then requirement for certification for some plans within Schedule D1, but all plans within Schedule D2.
Are you talking about the regulation requirements or PC1 requirements?
Within PC1.
Within PC1, yes, there's certification definitely for consented farms. Most cases, certification under PC1 is not required for permitted farms.
And your provisions certainly imply that certification may not be required for permitted farms.
Yes, well, I mean, it's Schedule D1 is a different kind of set of requirements, so farm plans really just need to make sure that those standards are met. So there is a difference there, yes.
And I guess by contrast, in the regulations, there is a blanket certification requirement, irrespective of whether a particular farm requires consent under the relevant regional plan or not.
Yes.
I'd like to take you to your provisions, the post-conferencing version.
Yes.
And page 42 of those.
Yes.
So this is Schedule D1, so this is in relation to those permitted farms.
Yes.
If we go down to the, about a third of the way down the page, and the new text under Part A.
Yes.
This is where you provide an opportunity for an FEP to be submitted prior to certification.
Yes.
I'm just interested in the second part of that that suggests that it must be resubmitted as soon as practicable following certification if any changes have been made.
Yes.
I guess what comfort does that provide the council as to whether certification has actually occurred?
Well, it's kind of the problem with the Freshwater Farm Plan regulations is that they require farm plans to be submitted for certification by a certain date. There's no requirement for it to be certified by any particular date. So that's kind of a problem. So I guess in this case, we're just sort of saying, so it may not be certified, but we need a farm plan under this.
That's your reason for allowing an uncertified farm plan to be lodged in the first place?
Yes, that's right.
But I'm intrigued as to why there isn't then a requirement for the certified farm plan to be provided.
Yes, and it's a very good question. When my thinking about this was that the farm plan regulations kind of gave us a gift. They said that most farms, and particularly pastoral farms over 20 hectares, need to be certified. Now, I like that, you know, because I do believe that that's useful in terms of ensuring that farm plans are good mechanisms. So I think that's good. I haven't done a Section 32 analysis in terms of what the costs of that might be versus any benefits of it. Of course, while the regs require it, then I don't need to do that, and so I haven't done that. I don't know at this stage, and certainly the hearing panel said they didn't believe there was enough benefit to require certified farm plans. What they said was that if you're a permitted activity farm that meets the standards and are required to do that, then is there a great extra benefit of then certifying that they meet them? So from a cost-benefit analysis, they said they couldn't really require it from that point of view. So I am pleased that most permitted activity farms will need to be certified. I'm not sure I could justify it in Section 32 terms still.
Certainly, but this is a context where for FEPs that are required to be certified by the regulations, wouldn't it make sense for the council to require a copy of the certified farm plan to be provided?
Well, and I think that's... does it not do that? I suppose not. Well, it says that the farm plan needs to be submitted and resubmitted if there's a change following certification. So is that not the same thing?
Well, I guess that given that there's an unknown time as far as the certification process. Wouldn't it assist the council to be able to have confidence that Farmer X has a certified farm plan in place?
I think what we've done, and I've just got to understand this, it all gets a bit complex.
As an alternative, simply just requiring that within X working days, say 20 working days of receiving certification, a copy of that certified farm plan is to be provided.
I mean, just got to get this right. What we've done, I think, with Schedule B two plans. No, that's not right. I thought, and I just can't find it right now, that we have made a change so that certification did need to occur by the dates in Table 311.2, but right now I can't find that. So we are trying to get a date when they would need to be certified. At least I'm thinking about the D2 stuff.
I think it is back to page 27. Is it 6D? Is that what you're referring to?
Oh, yes, sorry, that's right. So that was the idea, was to put a time limit on certification.
Yes.
Yeah.
But would you accept then that as far as determining compliance with that, then it makes sense for confirmation of certification to be provided to the council?
Yes, I think that's reasonable.
Okay, thank you. In terms of D2, for example, certification is considered by the council to be a critical component of that?
Yes.
And irrespective of any changes to the farm plan regulations, you see that as still being a critical component of the plan change one?
Yes.
And are you aware of the proposal by Mr. Willis to reference a particular date of the regulations to ensure that certification is a clear, consistent part of Plan Change 1?
Yes, I'm aware of that.
Would you support that?
It would bother me, I have to say, because we may therefore end up with effectively two sets of requirements, two versions of the farm plan regulations, both of which need to be complied with at the same time. And I don't think that's tenable personally. I would prefer that if there is a change to the regs in the future that creates a problem in terms of what PCMON's trying to do, that we address it then rather than trying to predict that there could be something that's changed that we don't like, that we need to find a fix, which where the fix itself could make things really complex.
Right. Well, as an alternative to being very clear that within Schedule D2, at least, that the FVP is required to be certified,
yes,
full stop,
yes,
and then having a separate reference, which is currently to the process and the regulations as far as how certification is to be carried out.
Yes, was that the question?
Well, as an alternative, would that be a more palatable solution to you to address this issue of ensuring that Plan Change 1 has a clear ongoing certification requirement, but avoiding the potential issue that you identified as far as having different versions of the regulation?
So, could you just describe that solution to me?
Certainly. So, being very clear that those farm plans under Schedule D2 are to be certified.
That's already clear, yes.
And then separately, as far as the process for certification, that is to be in accordance with the regulations as they may be from time to time, which is essentially the
seems to be what it says now, yes. I mean, the idea, yes, I don't know if the wording is right for it, but that's the right idea, I think.
Okay. I'm now going to move on to the permitted rule and for dry stock and around potential intensification risk.
Yes.
So currently under your rules, dry stock could increase their stocking rate up to 17 stock units or 13 winter cattle stock units before consent is required.
There's possibly some potential for it. We've tried to put in things to avoid that actually happening. And this is where it becomes really important in Schedule D1, Part D, Number 2A, which says, demonstrate at each 5-yearly review of the farm environment plan that the risk of nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment and microbial pathogens of water bodies does not increase over time by producing assessment of the risk of diffuse discharges for the farming operation through documentation of risks and mitigations using the appropriate risk assessment quantification tool. So that's what that's trying to do is avoid that situation. Whether it does it well enough, don't know, but that's what it's trying to do.
Yes. Because I was going to take you to that, because so that requirement is simply a 5-yearly requirement. It's not an annual requirement.
No,
for example.
Yeah, and the 5-yearly is just to match up with the regulations.
Do you consider that, given the need for everyone to do their bit as far as the achieving what we need to in terms of Te Tiriti Whai Mana, that being able to set and forget for 5 years is appropriate?
Well, I think the farmer needs to understand that that's a requirement, that they don't increase their risk of discharge. That's really important. And so there may be ups and downs with animal numbers, for example, but the intention and the requirement, in fact, is not to increase the risk of diffuse discharges.
Thank you. And in terms of the that part of Schedule D1 that you took me to,
yes.
Can you just explain what the Council intends with the reference to the assessment of risk that that provision contemplates?
Yes. This is where this whole question about tools becomes very important. Now, so I'm saying that the best tool or threshold for dairy is nitrogen risk scorecard, and the best threshold for dry stock is the stocking rates. There are a range of other tools that then could be used to show that the risk is not increasing. It might be the overseer model, it might be the NRS, of course, is good, the nitrogen risk scorecard. We know that that's good from the point of view of farm management, so that's good. We know stocking rate's not good, but it doesn't give us enough information. We know that there are tools coming from MFV which might be useful. So here, I'm just saying that there are new tools coming along all the time. Overseer is great in some situations, can be used, that's great, you know, but the right tool, the best tool needs to be used for the job at the time.
Yes. And so just dealing with this, that potential 5-year change as well.
Yes.
You may have heard questions that I asked Mr. Sinclair yesterday regarding whether reporting on an annual basis of intensity or an equivalent would assist the council from a regulatory perspective.
Yes.
And Mr. Sinclair referred to the issue of proportionality in terms of any intervention.
Yes.
And about a reporting requirement being at the lower end of the spectrum compared to certification and auditing and other forms of intervention as well.
Yes.
Your provisions already require a range of records to be kept by farmers, don't they?
Yes.
And so would you consider that being required to report on aspects of those, so particularly for a dry stock farmer, say, in stocking rate, is a significant additional requirement?
I might have to answer that a long way, a short way, I'm sorry. So stocking rate is a gateway. It's not a good risk indicator in terms of over time what's happening on the farm. The nitrogen reference scorecard is better, of course. I certainly understand the kind of trying to limit the burden that we have on farmers, and Mr. Sinclair has talked about that. We know that the regular reporting of the nitrogen, the NCAP, for example, is upsetting a lot of farmers because it's another thing that they've got to do. We know a lot of parties are asking farmers to report on various things at various times. So I agree with Mr. Sinclair that adding anything really needs to have a good reason. I don't want to go down the track of requiring farmers to prove their state permitted activity status all the time. So that's not where we're going to go on this. I do agree tracking change is useful, yes, and figure out what is the best way to do that. I don't at this stage support adding a requirement in a rule for annual reporting, because I think that's just going a little bit too far. I'm really concerned too about the regulatory load if there's kind of thousands of farms that need to regularly provide information, and if we get stuck in a situation of having to chase up lots of farms if they're not providing information. I just don't think we want to go there, personally. I actually think that some of the changes suggested, I think that the Schedule 1 Part D 2A requirement is a good start. I've been thinking about, should we require some additional words in Part C of the two schedules, which is the information provision, that does require annual reporting. I'm still not sure that I support that, but I do quite like the change that Federated Farmers have suggested in their legal submissions, where they're saying each year records are kept to demonstrate the stocking rates and nitrogen risk and scorecard does not exceed the limits. I think keeping records is good, which can then be brought into that assessment of risk over time to see if it's increasing or not. So I think that's a better solution than having a requirement and a rule that could create some real regulatory problems for us. That's my current thinking. Like I said, with all of this stuff, I've only seen it over the last couple of days, and I haven't done a real proper policy assessment of it yet.
Certainly. And just to be clear, as far as my questions, I use stocking rate, but it's equally applicable to dairy as far as NRS scorecard, but I understand your point.
Yes, and I do understand that a lot of the dairy farmers are very used to providing that information, you know, annually. But it could be quite a big change for dry stock farmers because they're not.
Now, earlier before lunch, you talked about the benefits of the site visit that you went on.
Yes.
And I think you referred to Mr. Various Farmers being at the, was at the extreme end of a difficult farm?
It looked that way to me, yes.
Yes. And I guess from a broader policy perspective, though, we have evidence before the court from a handful of farmers in different positions, but is it your view that in looking at rules that apply to thousands of farms, that we need to be careful of having those exception or the exceptional ones determining the rules?
Yeah, I find it very difficult, and it's always a problem with these sorts of things, that if you set your standards so that everybody can comply, then they're just not standards at all.
Going to move on to stock exclusion now.
Yes.
So again, that is, we've heard a number of witnesses referring to the importance of it, the strength of it as being a best practice tool. Would you agree with those sentiments?
Yes.
And it was very helpful, your explanation before lunch as well, or in questioning from my friend Ms. Tumai, as far as how you've reached the provisions that you have in terms of Schedule C. In that explanation, you referred to some of the points made by Mr. Pennell during the course of this week, that essentially the long-term desire is defence, and it's really a question of the time that that might take, and in the short term, what might be required. Is that a fair explanation of where you stand on that?
Yes, it is.
And so, really, as far as the situation where a farmer, for whatever reason, can't fence, is it really a question of timing then as to when that fencing should occur?
Yes, I think it's the big part of it. How it's pinned down and how that timing works for different farms could be different. That's the problem in my head.
And so, essentially, under your provisions, where either a farmer is on less than 10 degrees and can't meet the timing requirements, or is over 10 degrees and can't get a certifier to agree to alternative measures, that's where your controlled activity rule comes in, isn't it?
Yes.
And in terms of how that rule might work, what are the types of conditions that would actually be imposed on a farmer through that process? As far as drafting a rule like that, what are the types of conditions that you actually contemplate for that sort of consent?
I haven't turned my mind to that. I'm assuming that there may be dates at which certain amounts of fencing needs to be done, or some other mitigations need to be done. It's been a long time since I've written a consent as well.
But from a policy planning perspective, it is important to have that in mind, isn't it?
Yes,
particularly with a controlled activity rule where consent must be granted.
Yeah.
And so, just so I'm clear then, as far as the goal of that controlled activity consent pathway, it's really providing a longer time frame for fencing or alternative stock exclusion to be provided with some specific time frames for that? Is that the sort of concept behind that?
Yes, it is, but I think because it's a consent process, it just allows that to be set for that particular farm. It's allowing a case by case, what is the best thing we need to do here? What's the biggest problem here? How do we do it? When do we need to do it?
Yes. I want to move on to discretionary rule 311.47.
Yes.
So this is on page 32.
Yes.
In terms of the council's general approach to discretionary activities within its plan, it would be unusual for conditions to be outlined on a discretionary activity.
It's probably true, yes.
Do you see the risk of confusion in having set conditions in the context of a discretionary rule?
Yes, I can see confusion in it, yes. I guess, this rule has been through lots of changes, hasn't it? And it started off as a rule that was addressing farming on more than one property, et cetera, a few specific things, which was, I think, why it had conditions in the first place, but it was also a default rule. I've left those conditions in there because I think they provide some guidance in terms of applications that don't meet the other rules. Does that create too much of a problem? I'm not that sure, and I must admit I'm a little bit on the fence as to whether those conditions should stay or go.
Because what happens if you don't meet those conditions? Is there another provision elsewhere in the plan that dictates the situation?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't think so. So it becomes a nominate under the Act.
Okay.
So it will still be a discretionary consent anyway under the Act, and it will still have some guidance in terms of these conditions. Does it create a big problem? I'm still not that sure.
Certainly, no, that's helpful. The final... briefly on slope, the stock exclusion.
Yes.
The decisions version had a 15 degree threshold.
Yes.
And as I understand your evidence, the primary reason for reducing or changing that slope threshold from 15 degrees to 10 degrees was the availability of the MET maps. Is that fair?
That's right. There seemed to be a lot of people that didn't like having to measure slope, and so that was the next best thing.
And have you seen Dr. Dupree's evidence where he's using that same digital elevation model from MET being able to derive 15 degree slopes?
Yes, I haven't read it in detail, and I must admit I don't really understand whether his 15 degree map is comparable to the MFE ones. I don't know the answer to that, but you're telling me that it is comparable.
Well, if there was a comparable map, would that change your position as to what the appropriate threshold should be?
I don't have a strong view on whether it should be 10 degrees or 15 degrees. I don't know to what extent that would result in big changes to how well we achieve the objectives. So I think it's going to be somewhere around that number, as I understand it, in terms of difficulty of fencing. But I don't know which is the right number. I agree with the concerns that if there's less fencing, then on paper there's more risk to water, and therefore perhaps less chance of meeting the objectives. But I just don't think it's as simple as that, actually. What the farmers do on their property to reduce the risk to water, that's one of the factors, yes. So I just don't know the extent of difference to the objectives of that.
Thank you. The final issue or topic I wish to address you on is CVP.
Yes.
Are you able to assist the court as far as where you've got to as far as minimum standards for CVP?
Yes, I think minimum standards are great. It's just that we don't have any on offer at the moment that I'm aware of. I think there might be one, but I think it's good to have them, yes, in the same way that we have the Schedule D1 standards. And we do refer in Schedule D1 anyway to Schedule D1 Part D number 1 to the Fertiliser Association and the Vegetable, what they call Codes of Practice. So, I mean, that sort of stuff's already there, and that would have some kind of standards, I guess. So, yeah, I mean, it's always a good idea. It's just I don't know what they should be.
Yes. And essentially, again, going back to that earlier point we talked about as far as using the best available information, it's essentially, it is what it is at the moment.
Yeah.
But that's presumably something for future freshwater planning processes.
It'd be great if we could get something in place through that process, yes.
Yes. Now, in terms of crop rotation and potential expansion in CVP, you do support provisions that provide for crop rotation?
Yes.
But that's restricted to the sub-catchment?
Yes.
And that's intended to deal with the risk of CVP expanding in particular sub-catchments?
Yes.
Yes. And would you agree that policy 3B Roman 4 around offsetting compensation would be important for any CVP expansion?
Yes.
One final point in the context of policy 3B2. During the planning conferencing, there was discussion about whether there should be a further bullet point added to that policy about whether it would contribute to any local exceedance or further exceedance of the New Zealand drinking water standard for nitrate, nitrogen and groundwater?
Yes.
Can you just explain your position on that?
The position is that I don't actually know what the impact of that is. So I don't know how many sub-catchments, properties, areas that might impact. So I don't, it seems a good idea, but I don't, from any kind of cost benefit, I couldn't defend it as such.
But you'd agree that ensuring appropriate drinking water is critical?
I would agree with the ideas, but I just don't know what's the best way to do that. I don't have the information to say yes or no to that. Seems in principle a good idea. I just couldn't defend it in policy terms.
Certainly. Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you. Matheson, thank you. And registrar. Just for the members of the court, what I'm handing up is a copy of the council's version with my client's proposed changes included in it. Mr. Trebilko was given this a couple of days ago and provided an updated copy, so he's had a chance to look at them and hopefully we can speed things up. That will be attached to the legal submission, so I don't feel I need to provide you another copy unless you want one tonight or produce it. So we're just technically handing out in advance. No, Joe's and I. Thank you.
Somebody else mentioned they said, from the Federated Farmers submissions, and I was thinking.
Oh, yeah, no, that was the provisions. That was Mr. Trebilko. Right. I'm slightly worried I'd accidentally sent them.
thank you.
Right, thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm going to just to let you know where I'm going. I'm going to start with some high-level matters and then get into some specifics.
Yes.
Do you agree with the planning principle that regulation should be applied with the lightest touch necessary to achieve the desired environmental outcome?
Yes, that sounds good.
And that any work or effort required by a rule should be in pursuit of a specific environmental or RMA outcome?
Yes.
In other words, a rule should not require steps to be taken, monitoring to be done, reporting to be made, or information to be provided unless it serves the purpose.
Yes.
An environmental purpose. RMA purpose.
Yes.
In terms of Section 32, you agree that any provision must be assessed against Section 32 and 32AA?
Yes.
To an extent commensurate with the scale and significance of the cost, environmental effects, etc.?
Yes.
And that in undertaking that assessment, it's only the reasonably practicable alternatives that need to be considered rather than every alternative?
Yes.
And in considering what's reasonably practicable, a range of factors should be considered, including the time that might be needed to undertake any required works?
Yes.
The cost of doing those works?
Yes.
the extent of obligations, time and cost imposed by other related rules?
Yes. I don't know if that's what Section 32 says.
Yeah, but in part in terms of an overall Section 32.
Yes.
Yeah. To ensure that an option is reasonably practicable, the time frames for doing that work might need to increase. In other words, something might be reasonably practical to do over 10 years, but not over 1 year. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
And if you, in choosing a time frame for which a rule requires something to be done, if there's no obvious and quantifiable environmental benefit between doing it in year 1 and year 3, but in doing so imposes a cost, then you would agree to do it. The rule should say do it in year 3.
Well, I think you have to there may need to be a trade-off between the time frame to do something and the importance of making progress.
Yeah. And then the second stage of the Section 32 analysis is identifying out of those reasonably practicable alternatives which is most cost-effective and efficient. In terms of the context of PC1, do you agree that the objectives against which the provision should be assessed, at least in this regard, are the interim targets, not the long-term targets? Sorry, I'll be clear about my question. There's a specific interim targets objective in PC1, isn't there?
Yes.
And so the rules shouldn't attempt to do the 80-year target immediately, should they?
Well, I think if we can move further than the 10-year targets, why not?
Yeah. I'm just saying, I don't disagree with the need to get on with it.
Yeah.
I'm just saying the rules are not pretending to, and nor should they, try and achieve the final outcome with
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
And in terms of a planning sense, do you agree that it being effective means achieving the desired environment or the desired outcome?
Yes.
In the context of water quality improvements, do you agree that that will be on a farm-by-farm, stream-by-stream, catchment-by-catchment basis?
Yes. I'm not saying that the same improvement needs to happen on every farm.
But that's the point, isn't it? We don't know,
no.
But every little bit helps.
Yes.
In considering the efficiency of a provision, do you agree that it should be directed towards achieving the environmental outcome with the least effort and cost?
Yes.
That could mean imposing the least onerous activity status on an activity rule?
Maybe.
As long as you achieve the outcome?
Yes.
And in terms of a requirement to get a consent, it would mean the most focused AEE. In other words, if you're required to get a consent, you should focus on just those things you particularly need to assess and applying for that consent.
Yes, I guess so, but the requirement is really in the Act in terms of what information is provided with the application.
Yeah. In terms of assessing efficiency, you need to look at the scale and significance commensurate with the nature of the effects.
Yes.
In terms of assessing
it. Yes.
Do you agree, and then finally, in Section 32, once you've been through that process, are you aware that there's a requirement to quantify, if possible, the costs of...
Yes.
Do you agree that costs of $20, $50 or $100 million a significant cost that should be quantified if possible?
Yes. I also think the benefits should be quantified as much as possible in order to understand what those costs actually mean.
We had a discussion earlier about the 50 square metre wetlands.
Yes.
It was 500 square metres in the original decisions version?
No, it's always been 50.
It's always 50.
As a matter of fact, the notified version didn't have any limits. It was cattle to be excluded from all wetlands.
Sorry, not wetlands. I'm talking about other water bodies. So this is the size limit, the 500 square metre size limit. So did that start off at 50? I'll take it to the rule. Come back to it. Never go off screen. Okay, let's go to setbacks. Do you agree that the PC1 provisions are more stringent than the national regulation for stock exclusion?
Overall, yes.
And that's appropriate given the high bar set by Tauranga Whaumāna?
Yes.
Do you agree when considering the width of a setback, there are many factors for a certified advisor to take into account, including the nature of the topography?
Yes. Well, yes.
Because if it's on a plain, that might get one response. If it's in a stream in an incised gully in rolling country, that might get another response. And if it was a very high country, hill country stream at the very top of a catchment, that might need another response. So you've got to look at the
problem. Well, yes, but you can only do that through a consent process. But if we're looking at standards, it's very difficult to set those setbacks and describe different setbacks for different topography. I think that would be very difficult.
Right, but that's exactly what a certified farm planner is going to do.
Yeah, sure. Yes, that's right. But we still have to have the minimums in the plan.
Yeah, but you don't, the point, and we'll come to the provisions, but I mean, my question to you is you don't need to go through a resource consent process to get a plan certified, do you?
No, that's right.
And that would be more efficient, wouldn't it?
Than
having to apply for a resource consent just to get the same plan certified by a certified farm plan.
Well, that's not what the consent is for. The consent is to address the range of activities that you feel a significant need to do.
Sorry, I'll start again.
Yeah.
We're talking about flexibility around where setbacks are, correct?
Yes.
Yes. We can have minimum standards that say absolutely 3 metres.
Yeah.
And the proposal by my client and the provisions that we'll come to are a minimum of 3 or a minimum of 1 and an average of 3 if it's certified by a certified farm planner. Now, my question to you is, you don't need to go through a resource consent process to get a certified farm planner to certify the location of those setbacks, do you?
No, but I still think there needs to be reasonable protections from a regulatory point of view, which is different to a certified.
What would a consent processing officer add to that?
Well, I'm just saying there needs to be a minimum that works from a regulatory point of view in terms of what we're trying to achieve through the plan.
Yeah, and we've got minimums in there,
yeah.
But in some circumstances where the minimum can't be applied because of some topographical anomaly or something else, is it your advice that the only approach in those circumstances is to go get a resource consent?
My advice is that there needs to be minimum setbacks that are going to protect water bodies, that the activities at least those are complied with. There may be situations where you do want to have a more case-by-case setting of those standards, in which case I think it needs to be done through a consent. I'm not convinced that a certifier can do that regulatory task, if you like. They need to do, to me, they need to do a technical task, not a regulatory task. So I wouldn't mix the two up.
Okay. And this is very important for my clients, because on all of these waterways that are going to need to get confessed over the next 5 to 10 years,
yeah.
It's almost certain that in some locations it won't be practical to meet the absolute minimum.
Yes.
So there's 5,000 farms in the Waikato?
Yeah.
So what I'm putting to you is a certified farm planner who has experience for on-farm operations, correct? That's their job?
Yes.
They're going to be a lot more experienced in on-farm operations and minimising risk of contaminants to land than a consent officer in Waikato Regional Council, aren't they?
Generally, yes.
So they'll be in a much better position to decide what's the best way to achieve the objective, which in this case is to minimise contaminants into the waterway, aren't they?
Yes. Again, I think we've got to be careful that Schedule C is about stock exclusion and achieving those stock exclusion outcomes. It's not about fencing as such. So we're not just talking about fencing here.
And that's exactly my point, because shouldn't the purpose of this be to minimise loss of contaminants to water,
yes.
Not just require fencing.
That's right.
Yeah. And isn't the certified farm planner the best person to be able to work with the farmer on the land and determine what is the best way to minimise the loss of contaminants into water?
Yes. I'm just saying that I don't think it takes the place of regulation and standards.
Yeah, and I'll leave this for submission, but from everything you've said, I see no additional benefit that would come from getting a certified farm planner with significant experience on the site, walk the stream banks, decide exactly where the best place to put the fences are to ensure you have a efficient paddock layer, an efficient fence layer, minimise loss of contaminants to the water, overall achieve the best overall outcome, certify that farm plan, and then go to the council and spend $1,000 or $2,000 applying for resource consent. I just see no added benefit in that next step. Can you tell me what the benefit would be?
If you're asking me what the benefit of a consent over a permittivity is that what you're asking?
No, I'm asking you in the scenario I gave you, because I appreciate there are some permitted activities you can say it has to be 8 metres high and it's easy because you know it's 8 metres high.
Yeah.
We're in a situation where there needs to be a degree of qualitative judgment about what is the best outcome, and the focus should be on the outcome. So I'm saying my question to you is, what is the additional benefit after you've been through a certified farm advisor visit process to agree the step back of a length of fence? What's the additional benefit in going to council, paying the fee, going through a resource consent process, where all the resource consent would say is get and comply with a farm plan? What else is the consent going to do?
Well, again, I think there's still a difference between a regulatory response to an issue and a farm plan compliance response with the farm plan requirements. I still think there is a difference there, and I think there is a responsibility on council to make sure that the regulatory approach is the right approach. And I think there are cases where if it's really complex and the minimum sort of time frames and setbacks can't be met, I think it becomes as much a regulatory question as it is a farm systems type question. That's my feeling. I don't think it's as straightforward as saying, well, a farm plan and a certifier can basically deal with the issue so we can forget about it. I get the sense that's what you're saying. But
no, to be fair, I'm saying there's still a minimum. It's still 1 metre.
Yeah.
If the stock exclusion regulations require wider, then the stock exclusion regulations apply. Okay? So the stock exclusion regulations do have a minimum. So the certifier can't undermine the stock exclusion regulations.
No.
So they apply.
Yes.
So the situation I'm talking about would be streams that are not covered by the stock exclusion regulations, i.e. streams less than 1 metre, so not wide rivers.
Yeah.
Okay. And so my scenario is, we have a 10-15 centimetre stream, 20 centimetre stream, it's simply not practicable to have a 3 metre minimum setback. And the advice seems to be, well, I'm sorry, you need to go and get a resource consent.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying if that setback is generally impractical, then maybe the setback needs to be changed. But
as a minimum standard, the only way around the minimum standard is to go get a resource consent.
Yes, well, that's right. In this case, but I think what I understand you to be saying is that if the minimum standard is for a 10 centimetre stream to need 3 metre fencing, then that's what the problem is.
Well, that's what your rules require, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yes, at the moment they do, that's right. But I'm saying the discussion, therefore, should be about what is the right setback, not the regulatory process to address this problem.
Well, and my clients are suggesting a minimum setback of 1 metre on the basis that if it's a wide river, then the minimum setback of 3 metres would apply in the national regulations. Is that now your advice?
I don't know, it's getting a bit out of my area in terms of setbacks. It becomes a science in the farm systems kind of thing. The evidence I've heard says that a 1 metre setback is too small in terms of most streams, particularly most streams. So, it becomes a science question. I'm not sure I can answer that.
Yeah, and I'll ask my last question before the break. You referred several times in your answers today and to my friend to that's what the scientists say or that's what my science. Your role in advising the court on these rules
is
what do you support from a planning perspective?
Yes.
And you need to weigh up a lot more things than just what the scientists say, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. And so you've got to go through a Section 32 assessment process.
Yep.
My clients, and I think everyone will agree, the greater the setback on a stream, the better,
yep.
within reason.
Yep.
But as a planner and as this court setting the rules, you need to take more into account than just what the science is, don't you?
Yes, that's right.
Thank you. Was that a convenient place to pause?
That's, I think, where you were going for.
Yeah, just as well.
I don't want to enter into an argument with you when you're